Here's a look at our top stories this hour. A new survey shows 7 out of 10 Germans are using less energy amid the country's decades-high inflation and fears of Russian gas supply cuts. North Korea turns down South's offer of economic cooperation in return for denuclearization, calling it, quote, the height of folly and far from realization. Also, the Israeli military raids the offices of Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank as the regime intensifies its crackdown. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, a new survey shows 7 out of 10 Germans are using less energy amid a surge in costs due to decades-high inflation in Europe's largest economy. The survey by a Berlin-based research group, Infratest DMAP, shows those using less energy is up from 63% in April. A 35% rise in energy costs in the second quarter pushed Germany's inflation to 8.5%. The country is facing an energy crunch due to decreased gas supplies from Russia. Moscow cites technical reasons, but Berlin calls it politically motivated. The energy regulator says gas reserves will only be enough to run heating and industrial facilities for over 2 months if Russia completely halts supplies. That has prompted Germany to stockpile gas and accelerate its transition to green energies. Chancellor Olaf Scholz is expected to sign a deal to establish hydrogen supply chains with Canada during his upcoming trip. Scholz will also discuss the prospects of Canadian LNG deliveries to Germany. Energy-hungry Britain is now turning to coal or old coal-fired power units as a last resort to deal with shortages in the coming winter. The National Grid's electricity system operator, ESO, says the move is to ensure supplies in case other sources fail to provide enough electricity. The National Grid says it has signed contracts with power generators, Drax Group, and EDF to extend the life of 4 coal-fired power units, which were either closed or on the verge of closure. The ESO also says the available capacity will only be used when all commercial options are exhausted within the balancing mechanism. The upfront cost is expected to be between £220 and £420 million, and the units will be available until the end of March 2023. Britain, along with many European countries, is facing an energy crisis as a result of Russia cutting off its supplies. A fresh round of rail strikes has gotten underway across the UK, bringing travel chaos to millions of travelers for the next 3 days. The move comes after long-running negotiations between trade unions and the government over pay and working conditions failed to produce an agreement. Said Pureza has more in this report.
Another mass walkout bringing the UK's railway network to a grinding halt, causing major disruptions. Tens of thousands of signalers, maintenance workers, ticket collectors fighting for their rights as negotiations with the government for better pay and conditions hit the buffers.
I support the workers that are striking.
We're being inconvenienced, but they're being treated unequally.
Many rail employees, often working unsocial hours in a high-pressure environment, say they have seen no pay rise in 3 years, as the specter of soaring inflation, predicted to surpass 13% over the next year, looms over negotiations. The Conservative government has offered a below-inflation pay rise and accuses the unions organizing the strikes of taking the country for ransom. Despite that, public support for the strikes is on the rise.
I'm quite sympathetic to the train strikes and actually the other industrial unrest, because it comes on the back of minimal increase in wages over a long period of time, a pay freeze much more recently, and an offer which is frankly way, way, way below the current rate of inflation.
Stoking the public ire, comments by Conservative Prime Ministerial hopeful Liz Truss, who has pledged to restrict the ability of public sector workers to strike.
Liz Truss is seeking to take away human rights and the ability of the democratic right of people to express themselves through their trade unions and industrial action, which is one of the pillars of our democracy. It's only repressive regimes that stop people going on strike and stop them expressing themselves and stop them rebalancing the power in the workplace through their trade unions.
The opposition Labour Party, which receives funding from several trade unions itself, has also come under fire for failing to support the walkouts. The rail strikes, which also include London's underground and overground network, have set off a wave of industrial action that is set to get bigger, with teachers, health workers, and even barristers planning their own strikes.
Britain's so-called summer of discontent seems well underway, with a general strike more likely now than ever before, and with the railway workers in the eye of the storm. Saipur is up, London.
North Korea rejects an offer by its southern neighbor to help boost the North's economy in exchange for giving up nuclear weapons. Kim Yo-jung, the sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, calls the South Korean offer ignorant and the height of folly far from realization. She says the idea of exchanging Pyongyang's nuclear power with economic cooperation is just a dream of Seoul. South Korea's President Yoon Suk-yeol on Wednesday reiterated the country's willingness to provide economic aid to North Korea if it ends nuclear weapons development and begin denuclearization. It first raised this offer in May. North Korea test-fired a record number of long- and short-range missiles over the past months. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang is with us from Seoul. Jennifer, it's good to talk to you. So tell us more about the harsh rhetoric that North Korea's official, the sister of the North Korean leader, has used in order to turn down the offer.
Well, the harsh rhetoric is to be understood by everyone because I'm sure North Korea is shocked by the audacity of the Yoon Suk-yeol administration here in South Korea, which is basically offering the same sort of deal that conservative President Lee Myung-bak, who held office here from 2008 to 2013, offered to North Korea. And of course, that offer was rejected by the North. And some of the worst border incidents between North Korea and South Korea occurred during the Lee Myung-bak administration. Now, the Yoon Suk-yeol administration is trying to engage the North. It's beginning to get alarmed about its inability to talk to North Korea. North Korea is extremely angry because the South is about to hold large-scale military drills in the field with the U.S. for the first time since 2017. And from the 16th to the 19th this week, it has been holding preliminary exercises with the U.S. in the field in preparation for those large-scale drills, which will run from August 22nd to September 1st this year. And they have been sending self-propelled howitzers out into the field. And at the same time, they are making this type of offer to North Korea, which does not even go as far as the offer made by U.S. President Trump to the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un during the summits, the historic summits held for the first time between the U.S. and the North, which of course fell apart over differences between how much the North was willing to denuclearize and how much the Trump administration was willing to lift sanctions and offer security guarantees. So of course, the North Korean leader's sister, who is in charge of inter-Korean affairs, is going to be very upset. And in fact, the North staged cruise missile tests for the first time since January, this week on Wednesday, to show its displeasure with this type of audacious offer from the South, which it can never, ever accept. and also to protest these large-scale military drills in the field, which are going to be taking place here, which are a major provocation against North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, now let's discuss the issue from the perspective of South Korea. Yoon has been in office for about 100 days, and we know that opinion polls are now showing declining popularity and support for Yoon because domestically he's currently facing some problems. Now, how is he going to parlay this, the case of North Korea, the issue of North Korea, and the military exercises with the U.S. into all this?
Well, of course, these North Korea issues that he has a real problem just even dialoguing with the North to try to get it to denuclearize. This is adding to his woes here on the domestic front and his sagging approval ratings, which are the lowest that any South Korean president has had to endure 100 days into office. And these cruise missile tests were just taking place on exactly the 100th day of his office, Wednesday in the morning, before he held a huge speech that day, a press conference with reporters talking about all sorts of issues, including North Korea. This is just a ridiculous situation he is in, and the U.S. has also been very inflexible in the past. They have said they will only negotiate with North Korea if it completely denuclearizes all at once. Well, now that President Yoon is beginning to see the light and starting to take a softer line against South Korea, the U.S. also just said, announcing through its State Department spokesperson, that it is willing to take incremental steps in lifting sanctions and giving aid to North Korea in exchange for little steps towards denuclearization. So that shows you just how afraid the U.S. and South Korea are of North Korea, which is the biggest threat to them in the whole Indo-Pacific region. The North has massive nuclear weapons and ballistic missile capability. And not just that, but other types of weapons, tactical nuclear weapons, for instance, are a big threat. Those can hit South Korea. Its ICBMs loaded with nuclear warheads can break through the U.S. missile defense shield and hit any city in the U.S. And it's just too late to stop North Korea with, say, a decapitation strike, which the Yoon Suk-yeol administration has been foolishly planning. They think that if they can just take out the North Korean leader, that's going to ensure that the North does not, you know, prevail over them in a war, a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. That was Jennifer Chang, our correspondent from Seoul. Now moving on. Iran's foreign minister has reiterated that the revival of the 2015 deal, known as the JCPOA, hinges on respecting the Islamic Republic's red lines. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment in a phone call with his Omani counterpart, Badr al-Busaidi. The top Iranian diplomat said Tehran must also be able to reap the economic benefits of a revived agreement. Earlier this week, Iran provided the EU with its final conclusion on talks aimed at salvaging the pact. Tehran says it's now Washington's turn to show flexibility and take a realistic approach if it really wants a final agreement. The U.S. sent the deal into limbo after unilaterally pulling out of it in 2018 and reimposing sanctions on Iran. Talks have been held among the remaining signatories since April last year to rescue the accord. History professor David Yagubian says it's Iran's right to get assurances that it can reap full economic benefits of the JCPOA. Take a listen.
The ball is truly in the court of the United States now, and it does seem as though we have arrived at a point where the remaining issues relative to the what now 16 months of negotiations seem to be very close to being resolved. And so I think the real hang-up is the necessity for Iran to acquire assurances that it can indeed benefit economically from a return by the United States to the agreement, and as well that there must be some hook, some punishment for the United States if once again it decides to unilaterally pull out of the agreement and to basically break international law. I do believe that if the Biden administration can, at the very least, and I think this is critical, make the promise to stay in the agreement, to live up to its obligations, that this will still, considering the weakness internally within the American political system related to sustaining international agreements and international law, I feel like this is possibly, unfortunately, the best that the Biden administration can do.
Israel releases footage of its forces raiding the offices of Palestinian human rights groups in the occupied West Bank. The military says it closed seven institutions and confiscated property during the overnight raids. Senior Palestinian Authority official Hussein al-Sheikh censured the raids as an attempt to silence the voice of truth and justice. The European Union has declared support for the Palestinian NGOs, calling Tel Aviv's allegations against those organizations unsubstantiated. Israel has labeled six Palestinian rights groups, quote, terrorist organizations without providing evidence for its allegations. The regime recently passed into law the terror designation of three of those rights groups. Last month, nine member states of the European Union issued a joint statement saying they would continue to cooperate with those six groups.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Researchers find that the U.S. had become an outlier among other rich countries in mortality rates long before the pandemic, and that Americans are dying younger than their peers abroad. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Lynn Paramore, writer. This article is published under the heading, United States of Death? Study shows worrying mortality rates of broken health system. Here's the second part. In considering the widening gap between the U.S. and peer countries in the 2000s, Bohr points to the work of Princeton economist Anne Case and Agnes Deaton on death of despair, the term for lives lost to preventable causes like suicide, drug overdose, and alcoholism. Researchers like sociologist Shannon Monat, who has studied the opioid crisis, have built upon this work, trying to understand why these deaths occur so frequently in the U.S. Bohr mentions the combined stressors of economic dislocation due to globalization and the loss of jobs and economic opportunity in some parts of the country, especially among those lacking college degrees, and the social implications of these trends, such as increasing numbers of men without jobs who are no longer considered husband material and thus lose the social support that comes with marriage. Compounding the problem, in Bohr's view, is the failure of U.S. politics to address it or to even see it coming. And this was happening under both George W. Bush and Obama. As Bohr and his researchers note, inequality is surely a big part of the picture. In 2017, economist Peter Temin described how America began to diverge into what are essentially two separate nations in 1970s. One nation, around 20% of total population, boasts college educations, good jobs, and access to quality healthcare. The other nation, where the 80% majority resides, is stuck with low wages, insecure jobs, fewer education opportunities, and unaffordable and inadequate healthcare. These are the people getting sicker and dying younger than healthcare. These are the people getting sicker and dying younger than they used to. Temin observes that the U.S. economic structure now looks a lot more like that of a developing nation than a wealthy superpower, which may help explain why the country's mortality rates as a whole cannot compete with peer countries where such bifurcation is less pronounced. Thomas Ferguson, Director of Research at the Institute for New Economic Thinking, INET, has studied America's increasing turn to money-driven politics, which has resulted in public-minded policies giving way to free market-driven policies that do not consider the needs of the majority of the people. These two worlds, the high income and low wage sectors, interact less and less, which might explain why many affluent Americans, including the doctors who attend them, are unaware of how dire the U.S. overall health record has become and how many are dying young compared to peer nations. But the low wage world knows something about it firsthand. The COVID crisis has illustrated how many Americans are now simply ignored, but placed directly in harm's way, expected to sacrifice their very lives for the benefit of the affluent. This attitude was succinctly expressed by Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor of Texas, as the epidemic raged. As he said, "There are more important things than living," he stated, "like an economy that mostly benefits the few." Bohr acknowledges the need to discuss policies that would help the U.S. turn around its dismal mortality record, but he believes that the first step is to make the public aware of the urgency of the situation. Even he, an epidemiologist, has been taken aback by what he and his colleagues found. "What surprised me in this research is how huge the number of missing Americans is and how little a part of our public conversation. I'm sure if you did a survey, people would have no idea of the scale of excess mortality in the U.S. We're just way behind," he said. Unfortunately, if America was a patient, the doctor would likely be predicting a turn for the worse. For starters, the nation's pandemic response has been widely criticized, with data showing clearly that the U.S. record in saving people from the ravages of the virus is below the average in the world and among the worst among developed and high-income nations. That's certainly not helping the mortality crisis. In the broader view, the fracturing of the country into a dual economy is not improving. To add further stress, Peter Temin has illuminated in his most recent book that the racial disparities in the U.S. economy appear to be getting worse, not better. Unbridled capitalism is not good for life expectancy. For example, the increasing move of private equity into healthcare since 1980s in the U.S. has alarmed many experts, as INET has highlighted in research by Eileen Applebaum and Rosemary Batt, and also in work by Thomas Ferguson, Paul Jerkson, and Jai Chen on private equity's political contributions. A series of articles on the pressure put on emergency rooms by private equity to cut costs has further illuminated the danger to American lives from this rapacious part of the financial sector, which squeezes ever steeper profits from human bodies. Meanwhile, as the health of Americans is deteriorating, the Supreme Court attacks environmental regulation, gun protections, and delivers a shocking blow to women's health. If U.S. programs and policies of the 1960s expanded upon the gains that occurred in 1950s, then many of those in 2020s are doing the opposite. They are intensifying the failures of the past decades. Bohr says, "It's one of the tragic ironies of our era. Populations that have seen some of the worst trends in health outcomes over the last 40 years are electing leaders who will further exacerbate those trends through policies that are inimical to public health. Whether that's a failure to expand Medicaid, failure to regulate guns, or abortion restrictions that will lead to negative short-term and long-term health consequences for women." All of this points to the uncomfortable reality that U.S. democracy is not functioning as it should. When elected officials do not reflect the will of the people, which surely at a most basic level is to live, then something has gone badly wrong. The thing that I find most frustrating is that you'd expect in a democracy that the political system would respond when there is a mass health crisis, when people's material realities have been in decline, says Bohr, adding, "What you see is exactly the opposite. It seems very bleak, but then you think there has to be an opportunity for a new politics here."
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and how about pondering on a wise saying from the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, on freedom of conscience in the actual sense? The Holy Prophet's grandson told those who had ganged up against him, in the hope of getting the paltry positions of the transient world, "If you don't have religion, at least be free men in your worldly affairs."
Thank you. We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, the frankness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we're talking about a very important trait in the life of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. And this trait is the frankness of his words. Al-Imam Al-Hussein, Aba Abdullah alayhi salam, was a frank person. He used to speak frankly, openly. This means that he never spoke something that he felt, whenever he felt something should be told, he said it openly to the people without hiding anything. At a time when the Imam, you know, was badly in need of numbers and numerous helpers would have helped in his campaign, Al-Imam Hussein told his companions that, hey, whenever you feel like leaving me, you can leave me. I'm not forcing anyone to be with me. This is one of the very many examples of the frankness of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Al-Imam Hussein refrained from any kind of deception and frankly stated the true position to the multitudes who had been accompanying him. At the time, Al-Imam Hussein was going to face a bad time when he was going to face the happening of Karbala. So many Sahabas were accompanying him. And he told them frankly that this is not an easy path. It's a very difficult path. You should be ready for a difficult period in front of you. Whenever you feel like leaving, please leave now, because I don't want you to face what I'm going to face there unless you're ready to face it. This was so because those who have firm belief in God and His justice never has such defeats. Among the examples of his forthrightness is that on the 10th eve of Muharram, he gathered all his companions and informed them with absolute frankness that all those who shall remain with him will be martyred the next day. This is how frank Al-Imam Hussein was.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. We are talking about the frankness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. So we're talking about the frankness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. He was so frank. He was so open. It says that among the examples of his forthrightness, among the example of his frankness of his words, is that on the 10th eve of Muharram, Al-Imam Hussein gathered all his companions and informed them with absolute frankness. He told them that all those who shall remain with him will be martyred the next day. The Holy Imam explained to them in an open term. He explained it in an open words, very simple words, that hey, that they may have a clear idea about what they were doing. And he suggested them to go away in the darkness of the night. But you know, the great clan did not agree to leave him, and rather expressed their determination to be martyred in his company. People who believed in God and were people who believed in the message of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam and in the message of Al-Imam Al-Hussein, they stood firm with him because they had determination, and they said, it's okay, we have no problem to be martyred with if we will accompany you. We will accompany you, O Imam Hussein, even if it means we're going to be martyred in the path. So kingdoms are established and governments destroyed. But these lofty words that are the basis of eternity to every living being remain, because the lofty values are made prominent by it, such that man does not obtain any exaltation without it. This is the kind of the firmness, the kind of straightforwardness that Al-Imam Al-Hussein used to have at the time. He spoke directly with his mouth. He said whatever he felt should be said at the time. And he was so frank in front of anyone who stood in front of him. And this is the type of leadership that we need to study, that we need to know, we need to accept in our day-to-day lifestyle. Fi amanillah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. Silence, feel the air.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Lightning strikes are very powerful and misunderstood force of nature that we all often see being used in films. A spectacular lightning strike has illuminated the sky over the Scottish town of Dundee. A video from an eyewitness that captured the hypnotic scene has been shared on several social media platforms. The lightning in the clip can be seen sending several bolts in opposite directions. Below, a church spire is silhouetted against the lightning flashes. But lightning is not always spectacular, as sometimes it causes fire to tower and high rises. Last month, a wind turbine caught fire after being struck by a lightning bolt in North Texas, United States. Forestry authorities in southwestern China have opened a new canteen for wild Asian elephants in a bid to stop them wandering into villages. The canteen in Yunnan province provides the animals with attractive and nutritious meals while exploring man-animal harmonious coexistence. During these years, the province has explored multiple ways to reduce the encounters between humans and elephants and try to keep the animals away from farmers' crops. There are now approximately 1,400 hectares of dining halls for elephants, with many expanding from 100 to 240, such as corn, rice and sugarcane. They are planted on a large scale and within easy reach of the elephants. The location of such canteens is extremely selective, usually away from villages and major roads, and the chefs are locals.
Stunning scenes in Spain as the last supermoon of the year illuminates the night sky amid fireworks and fairs marking the start of festivities for a public holiday. In Malaga, fireworks left the sky a mix of colors against a bright moon. There was also a spectacle of drones that lightened the Sturgeon Moon. Locals in the Canary Islands also celebrated the three-day holiday by lighting up a Ferris wheel as the full moon beamed beautifully in the sky. If the moon is within 10% of its closest distance to Earth at the moment of full moon, it is called a supermoon. The supermoon has various hues and appears bigger and brighter than when the moon is at its farthest point from Earth. Have you ever heard of fighting nature with nature? Well, that's what the San Francisco Metro system in the U.S. did to stop pigeons from overrunning the place. The station has hired a hawk as the new guard to patrol the area. Pac-Man is a five-year-old Harris's hawk who has taken up the perch at the station. In terms of experience, he is pretty new as he finished training only 9 months ago. The station recently renovated its building, installing netting and spikes to prevent pigeons from nesting. But these birds still seem to find their way to hang around. So with the Falconer Force, Ricky Ortiz and his hawk were hired this summer to keep the pigeons at bay.
So a typical day is we get here, we make our round, we start off down in the bottom inside the facility, making sure there's no pigeons hanging out in there. And then we work our way up here to the platforms and just check the ledges and the roof and make sure that they're not trying to sneak in on us and keep them out. And he does a pretty good job of that.
The team patrols 3 days a week and Pac-Man is allowed to swoop in and scare any pigeons sitting around. The Falconer says less than half of the pigeons left after the first week of Pac-Man flying and establishing the territory. Commuters and station managers say they also noticed the difference. The Falconer says he usually keeps his feathery friend happy on the job by giving him snacks throughout the day. This also encourages the hawk not to feast on the pigeons and local rodents.
Technology helps transform the global food production system and mitigates its impact on the environment. China's autonomous region of Tibet is turning barren land into fertile one using greenhouse technology. Once removed, Beinong County is now the largest off-season vegetable supplier in Tibet. The region has taken advantage of its highland conditions to develop a state-of-the-art agricultural structure. Beinong has now more than 2,200 modern vegetable greenhouses and nearly 12,000 hectares of planting area, some built at unimaginable altitude. But one cannot deny the role of railways and highway transport for making this county a hub for organic vegetables. The income of locals has also been significantly improved, and they are now living a happy and prosperous life.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
If you're a private collector of wild animals, there is good news for you. A Pakistani zoo is auctioning off a dozen lions due to a lack of money to feed them and a space to house them. Lahore Safari Zoo currently has so many big cats that they have to take turns accessing paddocks. Officials say auctioning them will free up space and also reduce expenses. Zoo is currently housing 29 lions. The lions auctioned this week will be between 2 to 5 years of age. Each big cat is estimated to fetch around 150,000 Pakistan rupees. That's not too much, as some zookeepers claim. Even conservationists have expressed anger over auctioning lions to private collectors instead of transferring them to other zoos. Happy news for zoo goers in Nicaragua. Two adorable baby tapirs are born at a country's national zoo south of Managua, adding attractions to the visitors. Two endangered tapirs, a male and a female, were born hours apart at the weekend. In the video shared by the zoo, one of the newborns is seen suckling and walking near her mother. The director of the zoo says the babies are yet to be named but are in perfect health. Tapirs inhabit jungle and forest regions of South and Central America, with one species inhabiting Southeast Asia. They look something like pigs with trunks, but they are actually related to horses and rhinos. Nicaragua launched a project that seeks to conserve this animal in danger of extinction due to hunting and the destruction of natural habitat. Now we'll take you to mine-riddled French island, Chesomes, which is emerging from the ruins and gradually turning into workers' paradise. Chesomes, close to the port city of Saint-Malo, has an amazing landscape but remains uninhabited as it saw a devastating bombardment by the Allies during the World War II. The Nazi-occupied island was victim of the most bombings per square meter. Known as Martyred and Forbidden Island, it was opened only in 2018 after extensive demining efforts allowed the opening of a marked path. Now, every year, thousands of day trippers make the short boat journey, marveling at the spectacular maritime views and flourishing wildlife there. The safe area still makes up just 3% of the island, but it lets visitors wander between rusty cannons and bunkers. Some workers say they hope the trail will be lengthened to allow a complete tour of the island.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism. The Jamtal Glacier in Austria has been losing around 1 meter of its surface annually. Scientists say the ice is a precious archive that is simply melting away and are surveying the area. Austrian mountain researchers say the glaciers contain an invaluable trove of ancient frozen leaves and twigs and other scientific treasures that can be lost forever. They say the time capsules, including the remote Jamtal Valley, are falling victim to climate change. In the 1990s, tourists found that 5,300-year-old mummy of Iceman near the same area. According to the international data, global warming has raised temperatures in Europe's highest mountains by nearly 2 degrees Celsius in the past 120 years. French rescuers are racing against time to save a beluga whale stranded in Seine River near Paris. The beluga was first spotted stuck between two locks in the river from Paris to the English Channel on Tuesday. Specialists say the animal is undernourished and is refusing food. Warm water is also worsening the health of this creature, which is normally seen near Norway, some 3,000 kilometers to the north. Rescuers say they have only up to 48 hours to save the whale. They are now looking at the possibility of taking the beluga out of the water, treating it, and eventually transferring it out to the sea.
There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day since the menu largely includes local flavors.
Visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, five lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A choice between austerity and populist bigotry is a brutal one, and it portends a bleak immediate future for government in the UK, says David Renton Ryder in an article published under the heading, "The contest to replace Boris Johnson is a choice between austerity and bigotry." Stay tuned for more. Boris Johnson's government will go down in history as a record breaker, just not, however, for achievements of which any prime minister will be proud. His government began badly. On being appointed prime minister, he suffered a series of defeats in the House of Commons. In the British Constitution, prime ministers are not directly elected but hold office by virtue of their ability to command the confidence of Parliament. If a government cannot sustain a majority in the Commons, it is supposed to resign. Johnson lost his first four votes in Parliament and 12 altogether in autumn 2019. Over the next 2 years, Johnson cut spending on health and education, awarded billions in government contracts to his allies, and presided over a COVID pandemic in which Britain had among the worst death rates in Europe.
Johnson's government ended even worse than it began. In a two-day period between July 5th to 7th this year, 57 government ministers resigned rather than serve under him. Never before in British history had so many senior members of the executive quit at once. For all his reputation as the great survivor of British politics, he's now leaving power, and the race is underway to select his successor. The winner will be chosen by Conservative Party members by a public vote from a list of two candidates, with the winner to be announced on September 5th. Rishi Sunak, previously the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and Liz Truss, the Foreign Secretary. In theory, Sunak should be the favorite, as he has held senior office for longer and was nominated by a much larger number of Conservative members of Parliament. Sunak is the richest MP in the House of Commons as a result of his marriage to the Indian heiress Akshata Murthy, whose father, N.R. Narayana Murthy, often called the Indian Bill Gates, founded the Indian tech company Infos. Sunak has long been criticized for the way he and his wife handled that family business, which included his wife declaring herself a non-domiciled resident of England while he was a chancellor to avoid paying taxes. Sunak takes into leadership content one defining policy, which is that Britain overspent during the COVID crisis and now needs to work hard and make sacrifices. Sunak resigned as Chancellor because of Johnson's lack of support for budget cuts, setting in motion the series of resignations which led to Johnson's removal. This idea is especially important since gas and electricity companies are expected to hike energy rates by 70% for most households, a sum large enough to force millions into poverty. Johnson has refused to set in place any protection for those affected before he leaves office. If elected, Sunak would offer the victims of those price increases nothing. Sunak is not exactly a social liberal, but he does not appear to be comfortable playing the role of a populist. Late in the contest, he delivered a speech warning about work nonsense, but this was given later and very obviously in response to what is perceived to be Truss's success in wooing the Conservative base. In contrast to her, Sunak represents a return to the politics of austerity that dominated in Britain before 2016 and whose wider unpopularity created the internal revolt in Conservative politics that was expressed in Brexit and the rise of Johnson. Liz Truss, by contrast, has portrayed herself as a continuity pro-Johnson candidate. In days when neo-Nazis have been picketing public libraries and demanding the cancelling of story times hosted by drag queens, Truss has tried to claim the leadership of the anti-immigration policies. Truss also promises to support and extend Boris Johnson's plans to rip up the UN Refugee Convention by deporting refugees to Rwanda. Like Sunak, Truss has nothing to offer the victims of rising fuel prices. Unlike him, however, she argues there is an alternative of sorts to rising inflation and falling living standards. Truss insists that rather than cap prices or limit the profits of the oil giant companies, what the government should be doing is slashing taxes for the richest people in society. She represents herself as the enemy of financial experts and businesses, a message amplified by her supporters who contrast Sunak's £450 shoes to Truss's £4.50 earrings. But this look is about positioning, not helping the poor. Another of Truss's big ideas was to pay for those tax cuts by cutting the pay of some of Britain's worst-paid public sector workers. Truss has termed campaigners calling for a Green New Deal militant activist and pledged to press on with the conservative plans to criminalize protest. Boris Johnson had already published plans to water down Britain's Human Rights Act, which requires governments at all levels to behave in a way consistent with essential rights. Truss promises to abandon that human rights framework altogether. Such policies have made Truss Deb Wookie's clear favorite to win. Like many other countries right now, Britain has the feel of Europe after the First World War.